This is the Dreamers Podcast, where dreamers share their stories to inspire you. Now, join host Joe Pardo as he interviews a dreamer who's living their dreams.
Welcome to the Dreamers Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Pardo, and today I am interviewing Jason Nordhoff, who is living his dream through public service. Welcome to the show, Jason.
Hey, thanks for having me, Joe. I'm glad to be a part of this project you have going on here.
Well, thank you. I'm really glad that you could come out and be here in the studio with me. Let's get started by giving some background about yourself.
I'm 27 years old, graduated with a BA in political science from Rowan University in Glassboro. And I currently work as a police dispatcher for the county, which covers the various law enforcement agencies that have jurisdiction over the 24 towns in the county. You know, I started in public service at a very young age. Going back to the genesis of it all, my grandfather has spent the last 61, 62 years in the fire department, somewhat active, albeit he's 80-some years old. And then my father spent 25 years in the fire department and has continued his public service in other ways. And you always see your family and your father and your grandfather, and you almost want to mimic them to an extent. And that's something that I've done. Joined the fire department for a short time myself, started going on mission trips with the church, went on to other things with my free time.
So what would you say inspires you?
What inspires me is the result of a good action, whether it's seeing a smile on someone else's face, seeing how they are definitely impacted by your actions and your words, really inspires me to continue to do good things for other people.
So you touched a little bit upon how you wanted to mimic your family growing up. How exactly did your dream come about, though, to you?
I remember vividly when the fire department was having their 100th anniversary. I want to say it was in 1998, and you had to make sure all the equipment was, you know, shined and polished, and they were putting together a parade and different events surrounding the anniversary, and my father and grandfather were all active, and they had brought me along to help with them, so I was very hands-on within the department, at least on the very non-emergency side of things, since I was... I had to have been 10 years old at that point, or 10 or 12 years old. I couldn't join until I was 14. But getting hands-on before I was old enough to actually become a member myself really gave me some insight on what I could expect going into the future. And I really liked what I experienced, and then that prompted me to move on to other things.
So how was your dream received by your family when you told them, hey, I'm going to do everything that you guys do?
Well, my mom hated it, which... She loved the public service aspect of it, and she was glad that I wanted to serve my community. But she saw how much time that was dedicated to the organization, missing dinners and being away from the family during holidays and things like that. Because if an emergency occurs, there's no schedule for that. It happens, it happens. You go out, and you have to make a lot of sacrifices in order to be good at that. So there was some kind of, I wouldn't say discouragement. People were trying to make sure that I knew what I was getting into. And that's not a bad thing to have in. You always want to see all sides of an issue when making a decision on what you're going to do. So I'm glad to have the support on both sides of any issue that I have.
So what steps did you take to get started with your public service?
Before I actually was able to join the fire department as a junior member at the age of 14, at age 12, I had started going on mission trips with one of the local churches down in Kentucky, where they support 3 of the 10 poorest counties in the country, where they support a K-12 school, a private Christian school, a dental clinic, a health clinic, economic development, an extension of different government programs that the government couldn't really handle themselves, so they worked with the church to get it out to the community. I got involved in that because my brother had gone on the very first trip with our local church, and then I saw how good of a time that he had and the impact he had on other people's lives in that area of the country, that when I was old enough, at age 12, my sister and my mom and I, we all went down with the church together. And I think one of my first projects, the one I'll never forget, is helping to install part of the playground at the school that I know is still standing there today, and I know the kids still enjoy.
Oh, that's very nice. Were there any roadblocks with getting started?
For that particular mission, not necessarily, no. It was just a matter of waiting till I was old enough and then having to have the parental supervision of my mother, you know, since I was still young. But it was just a matter of helping out with fundraising because it was a group of, I think back then it was 45 people. Today, there's a group of at least 100 people that go down. Imagine 100 people traveling 14, 15 hours by van to spend in a... a work camp atmosphere, you know, raising money for vans and things like that, hoagie sales, car washes and such. But that wasn't there was no real barriers to me personally getting involved. It was just finding the willingness and desire to put myself in an uncomfortable situation, something new. And once I got past that, it was all downhill from there.
What about with public service? Was there any roadblocks with that?
With public service in general, I think the biggest roadblock is oneself. You have to have the desire, you have to have the passion, you have to be willing to make your own sacrifices. Sometimes they're small sacrifices, sometimes they're big sacrifices. A lot of it depends on the type of public service you want to do. Whether it's you want to go volunteer with the church, you want to volunteer with your local fire department, you want to volunteer at the local food pantry. It's just a matter of reaching out and creating your own opportunities. And I don't think there's too many organizations out there that are going to decline help if you offer to give it to them.
How did you go about overcoming those?
A lot of it was the examples from my family and friends. You know, I saw my brother having a good time on a mission trip. I believe my mother did a trip before I went down, or my sister. You know, and then seeing my father and grandfather, just seeing the impact that they've had on the community around them, just having good examples in your life. And that's something that I would like to strive to be, is an example of someone who still has a great personal life while being able to help others and to maybe get someone excited about public service themselves, to find their own way of helping other people. It doesn't have to be the same way, you know, same things that I've done, but I would encourage anyone to go find what they're good at. There's a lot of things in this world that I'm not good at. I can't run marathons. I can't run into burning buildings. That I've given, you know, that dream up, unfortunately, but through various physical limitations and other limitations that I have. But instead of worrying about what I can't do, I have to start worrying about what I can do. And I think a lot of people need to start thinking that way as well. If I concentrated on things I couldn't do, I'd be laying in bed all day doing nothing, maybe playing video games or watching TV.
Before the interview, you were talking about stuff that you've done for New Jersey as far as bill writing. Do you care to elaborate any of that?
Sure. When throughout my college career, it took me 8 years to get my bachelor's degree. I spent some time at the College of New Jersey outside of Trenton. I got to intern at the same time at the State House in Trenton, and I was very fortunate to have it to be more than just baking copies and fetching coffee for people. I got to do real work. I got to see how legislation was actually made and have a hands-on approach to it. The Speaker of the Assembly, who was Joe Roberts at the time, said he wanted to create a package of legislation that dealt with the growing rate of autism within the state of New Jersey. I think at the time it was 1 in 98 people had autism. It was a wide spectrum from Asperger's, which is one of the least severe on the spectrum, to, I guess, you know, very autistic, low-functioning autistic. One of the ideas that we came up with, I got to work with one of their staffers, was I went back on my experience with public safety. And the idea came about that we wanted to require emergency services personnel to be required on how to interact with people with autism. I heard stories around the state of police officers not treating people with autism properly, EMTs and paramedics and things like that. And it was a huge liability on these municipalities and these agencies, where if they didn't handle it properly, they were opening themselves up to lawsuits. But beyond that, more importantly, was the safety of the person with autism. One of the biggest stories that affected me was a highly functioning kid. I shouldn't say kid. He was driving, old enough to drive. He was pulled over by the police, and he had autism, but he couldn't convey to the officer he had autism. And the cop didn't realize he had autism, so the kid just got out of the car and started running, which prompted the officer to chase him and arrest him. And I'm not sure if the kid had any serious injuries or not, but you imagine a well-built officer tackling you to the ground trying to arrest you. I'm sure it doesn't do nice things to your body. So in order to prevent that, we wanted to make sure that police officers were trained on how to not really diagnose autism, but on how to recognize certain signs and symptoms and how to really approach people with autism so you can avoid bad situations like that. And it was signed into law in 2008 by Governor Corzine, which was after I ended my internship. So I was real excited when I got an email about that going through. Other things that we did, other legislation we worked with, was protecting the jobs of volunteer emergency responders. Say you get paged out in the middle of the night to fight a burning house fire, you're going to be there for quite a few hours, especially if it's a really bad fire. And then all of a sudden, you're in the middle of putting out the fire, but you have to pack up and leave as an individual because you have to get to work. Now, we found that quite a few people were getting fired from their jobs for not calling, not showing up, which obviously for the employer's point of view is bad because now you're down an employee and productivity goes down. But we've built legislation that was signed into law in 2010 by Acting Governor Steve Sweeney that gave protections to both the employee and the employer at the same time, allowing these people to serve their communities on a volunteer basis. So everyone wins. The employee wins, the community wins, and the employer wins. You know, it was something very proud that I could have my hands on. I can't take credit for anything, but you know, just to know that I played even a small role in that really means a lot to me.
So you mentioned that you work in a call center, and right. Would you like to elaborate some more on what it's like working in a call center? Most people probably have never even called a call center for 911, let alone been in one or right. talked or even knew anybody that worked at one.
Yeah, I started in September of 2007, and what was really cool at the time is my father had worked there, and he had tried to convince me not to take the job because he knew how stressful it was. And at the time, I was still working on my education. I was still four or 5 years away from finishing my degree. But I went ahead and did it anyway because I knew what the job was about based off of some stories that he said. But I'm glad I'm still there and only another 32 years to retire if I'm lucky. But it's interesting. I can be on the phone, typing on my computer, and talking on the radio to field officers out in the field all at the same time. And anyone who's had to multitask at their job, it's not necessarily easy when you're trying, especially when you're worried about different emergencies. You know, this officer is chasing this guy on foot, or this vehicle won't stop for them. Meanwhile, you're on the phone with somebody reporting a large fight on the other end of town. Meanwhile, you're typing everything into the computer, seems all at once, and it can be difficult at times, but I work in a group of no fewer than 12 or 14 people in the room at one time, and there's a lot of teamwork that has to happen. You know, we all get it done, and at the end of the day, knock on wood, everyone's gone home safely.
Yeah, I don't know that I could imagine doing that job, especially the hours that you work.
Yeah. I do 12-hour night shifts from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m., about 14 nights a month. So I average about 42 hours a week throughout the course of a month. We have times where we're really busy. Phones won't stop ringing. Officers won't stop being proactive, reaching out to the community in different ways. And then there's times where nothing happens at all. And those are the times that we really try to enjoy. But, you know, we've had different situations over the course of the years where, you know, me personally, I've dealt with hostage situations, suicidal people, domestic violence situations. So seeing what real people go through on a daily basis and seeing what people's real problems are, whether it's drugs or alcohol or spousal abuse or people just being people, not being very responsible people, has really given me focus on things I need to concentrate my life on in the future. I've done a lot of stuff in my past, but that's all in the past, and I'm only 27 years old. There's a lot of stuff in the future that I really need to do, and I can't worry about what's in the past. I can't just phone it in from here on out. And I'm hoping to be alive for another 60 years at least. So, you know, there's a lot can be done in that 60 years.
Well, one of those things was donating a kidney.
Right. In 2012, I was approached by one of my friends And he actually, I wasn't even approached by one of my friends. I'd seen on Facebook that the father of one of my best friends was looking for a kidney. I didn't know the circumstances behind it. I'd never even heard anyone ever talk about this ever before. So I had sent a text message to my friend, and he said, "I'll let you know." And 6 months goes by. I don't even remember. Probably 6 months. That was in April, and he called me in June. And I knew there was a problem because he normally sends me a text message rather than calling me on the phone. But he called me, and he asked me if I was still interested in donating a kidney. I'm like, great, let's knock this out. I can take off. Fortunately, I have a great job that would allow me to take a lot of time off for recovery from surgery. Let's do this next week. Let's just knock it out. And he's like, well, I don't think it works out that way. We went through testing, and 2 years later, and I finally got to donate my kidney. So it was very stressful at times, not knowing if I was an exact match. Then we switched hospitals. We ended up going to Lady Lourdes in Camden to get the procedure done. January 14th, 2014, we went to Lady Lourdes, and next thing I know, I'm laying in bed with one less kidney. But it's something that I'm really glad that I got to do. Bill is my recipient. He was diagnosed with renal failure due to diabetes and high blood pressure, which is determined to be a genetic cause rather than him abusing his body. It was genetics, which you obviously can't control. And he had to do a lot of work changing his diet and things like that. He was very blessed that he was able to wait those 2 years. Usually the numbers get significantly worse for his kidney function, but they stayed stable. He was able to make it through those 2 years of testing. Now the doctors tell him that if they didn't know any better, he's a perfectly normal human being. You know, he still has to watch his blood pressure and his blood sugar and things like that, but he's got 2 grandchildren, you know, he's got 5 kids, and he's able to spend time with them now. He's even looking to open up a new business with one of his friends, a barbecue business, and he's really excited about that. I spoke to him as recently as a few days ago, and everything is great. He couldn't be happier. His family couldn't be happier. I'm glad I could do it. A lot of people ask me, why would you want to donate your kidney? And I say, why not? And that's what a lot of people need to work through, is there's a lot of people that will, you come up with an idea, come up with a project, and people say, well, why do you want to do that? And my answer is, why not? You have to take people's negativity and turn that into a positive. You know, there's issues like homelessness, which I haven't tackled personally, but I know there's issues of homelessness in the inner cities especially. Let's take Camden, for example. Why would you want to help Camden out? They're a lost cause. Well, no. You know, you have to look past the negativity and just go forward with whatever project you think will make the biggest impact. Now, what has resulted from me donating my kidney to this individual is a stronger friendship between his family and I, him and I, his family and I. One of the negatives, I wouldn't say negatives, if there could be a negative out of this whole process, is now he's going to be on anti-rejection medication for the rest of his life. And that comes at a premium. It's very expensive. So what we have done is, I'm also a member of the Elks Lodge. I was talking to a few friends in the Elks Lodge, and we've decided to start a charity cornhole tournament. If anyone's not familiar with the cornhole, it's also known as bag-o. Generally, you see them at tailgating parties or picnics where you're throwing the bean bags on the boards and you try to get it in the hole. So we're doing a charity tournament on June 14th and trying to raise as much money as we can to help him pay for his medication. Like I said, it just doesn't end at the initial act. There's more to follow. And then once I'm done with that project, I'm going to try to find another project. So I'm trying not to let the past hold me down when I can look well into the future. One of the signs of our close relationship, my kidney recipient and myself, is participating in different events. Him and his wife and his grandchild joined my family in doing the Walk to Cure Psoriasis at the Philadelphia Zoo. We got together, there was 7 or 8 of us who had joined my team, and we raised money. I think we raised over $800 to help fight psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis, and that was in April of 2014. Psoriasis is something that my recipient's wife deals with, and it's also something I've dealt with from childhood. So beyond just helping him with his kidney, he has returned the favor in a very small way that he would admit by helping me raise some money for something that affects me. Whereas I helped him, he helps me. And then together we're, you know, I know his new business, he was looking to use the proceeds or pay it forward from receiving a kidney to hopefully opening this business soon and giving part of the proceeds. I believe he was talking about recently the Gift of Life Family House, which I'm not overly familiar with, but clearly is something that is close to him after having a renewed chance at life. So hopefully we can have more people have the same effect.
So is there any parts of your dream that haven't quite worked out yet?
I think the biggest reason things fail in public service is personal priorities change. Whether it's, I know at one point my priorities changed to where I wanted to finish my college degree. So I left town, albeit not that far, and tried to accomplish that. So I had to shift my priorities. And as I interacted with new people and met new friends and acquaintances, my priorities shifted again. And as I start to think about creating a family and getting married and possibly having kids, priorities change again. So to say something doesn't work out when you're thinking about, when you're in the field of public service, I don't think that's a proper way to phrase that. Changing priorities is probably the best way to discuss that.
Before we get into the next question, I did have a follow-up question. Has there been any complications for you after you've given the kidney?
I can't think of any complications personally. The only thing, I'm not at any higher risk of kidney disease because generally speaking, when you have two kidneys and you get a kidney disease, it affects both kidneys just the same. They both generally fail at the same time. And there's plenty of people who have either, whether it's people are born with one kidney, people have given one kidney, so now they're down to one, or people who have received a kidney and they only have one. So there's lots of people who only have one kidney, and it's a very normal thing. If we had to live with two, there would be no such thing as a kidney donation. But for some, whatever reason, whether it's, you know, we were able to live without one. But, you know, I don't party as hard as I used to. I know I love to, especially, you know, I don't know whether it's because I'm getting older or it's my kidney function or whatever, but, or it's just a personal choice. I haven't really decided that yet, but I know I don't party as hard. But other than that, medically, the only thing I'm at higher risk of is higher blood pressure. I keep that under control. I did a 2-week follow-up with my surgeon, a 6-week, and I'm scheduled for a 6-month checkup in July, and then a 1-year and I think a 2-year follow-up. So I'm continually getting monitored by the surgical center, and I'm also encouraged to follow up with my family doctor to get regular physicals to make sure nothing gets thrown out of whack there. But I'm a perfectly normal person. I was out of work for 3 weeks. I used, fortunately, over the 7 years I've been employed there, I was able to save my sick time to be able to facilitate this. And I went back to work, fortunately, working in an office atmosphere. I was able to return sooner than some other people who have been through the same procedure. But I can do physical activities. The only thing I can do physical activities. If I want to go running, I can do jogging, bike riding. I can go swimming. The only thing that they recommend I don't do is physical contact, such as soccer, football, things like that. They want me to keep to low-intensity recreation. But other than that, I'm a perfectly normal person. And fortunately, because I was able to give my kidney, my recipient, who's twice my age, is also back to normal. So, you know, we can do hopefully the running and the biking and all that other stuff together one day.
So, if you were stranded on a deserted island with your family, what 3 things would you want to have with you?
Oh, my. If I was stuck on an island, well, there's no doubt that in today's age that I would have to bring my phone. My luck, I would bring my phone and there would be no service. You know, you can ask my girlfriend how attached I am to my phone. She's not very happy with me sometimes. So that would have to be one thing. Another thing would have to be, it's tough because my phone does so much stuff. It's my music player, it's my book, it's my movie player, it's my, it's everything rolled into one. There, I think the other thing that I would bring, if it had nothing to do with survival, the 3 things I would bring, I think I would have to bring something that reminds me of home. I would probably bring, there's an American flag that was gifted to me by my sister. She's in the Army National Guard that she served 2 tours in Iraq. And on one of her tours, she had brought home a flag that was flown over one of the bases, and she brought home a little certificate certifying that, yes, this flag was in Iraq over the American base, and she brought it home, put it in a little case with the certificate in a little frame, and it's sitting in my living room right now. So if I would bring three things, that would be one of them. So I'm up to my phone, my American flag. I'd bring a boat. No, that doesn't even count. You can't bring a boat because you're stranded on an island for a reason. Would be a board game, whether it be Taboo or Cards Against Humanity, which I know has gained popularity in recent years in this country. Because I'm big in family game night. We get together. We try to get together as people, again, as priorities change, things change. But we try to get together once a month at least to, as a family, to interact with each other and talk and make fun of each other and just share each other's fellowship and stories. And I think that's huge. I wouldn't want to go to a deserted island and go our separate ways and not talk to each other and just get mad at each other all the time.
So what do your dreams for the future look like?
My dreams going into the future, in the immediate future, are doing a cornhole tournament for my kidney recipient so we can help pay for his anti-rejection medication, which he'll be taking for the rest of his life, hoping to raise at least a couple $1,000s, and we're a couple weeks away now. So that's my immediate future. In the long-term future, I would like to be, selfish for a little bit compared to some of my past actions, and eventually sit down to get married and start a family. And see where my priorities take me from there. I know with my kidney donation, my priorities have changed to kidney donors, the whole process of living donors. I would like to get into advocacy for a different legislation that promotes live-in organ donations. I know there's legislation that's been kicking around since 2004 to give a tax deduction to living donors to help them bear the cost of donating a kidney. With the state's financial issues, that could may not ever happen, but to be able to keep that alive would be something that I would like to do. Get involved in other people looking for kidneys. I know immediately after I donated my kidney, I don't know whether it was a coincidence or there's a greater need for kidneys, but I noticed one of my coworkers needed a kidney all of a sudden. I don't know whether it's all of a sudden it happened or all of a sudden I became aware of it. One of my coworkers needed a kidney. A relative of one of my other best friends needed a kidney. And I'm reading stories online of people just using social media and begging for kidneys. Becoming an advocate and making myself available to other people who may be interested in that process. Answer questions for them because it's not for everybody. Some people shouldn't do it. Some people are afraid to do it. So if I could answer their questions and just promote the process in itself, maybe we can extend a little bit more joy and extend people's lives a little bit longer.
Unfortunately, I won't be able to be at the cornhole tournament because I have a wedding I'm right. The best man of. Do you have any last thoughts to share?
Pretty much, there's the saying goes, those who give receive 10 times over, or the saying something like that. I'm not sure exactly what it is. But I've definitely given a lot so far, and hopefully I have a lot more to give. But I've definitely been blessed or lucky or however you want to say it to have a great life, to have a very supportive family, to have a great girlfriend, to have been able to get a college education, to have a great career. So I've been blessed in many areas of life. I would encourage everyone to, even if it's something small, to do something for somebody else, whether it's donating food to a local food bank, or like I did actually this morning, donating clothes to the local thrift shop. That's something very easy you can do. Or finding a charity you like to donate money to, or if you don't have the money, donating your time. More valuable than money is donating your time. I know my sister most recently told me she signed up for the Boys and Girls Club. She lives up in Mercer County right now, outside of Trenton. And she signed up to be a, actually it was Big Brother's Big Sister. So my sister recently signed up for Big Brother, Big Sister. So she's now a Big Sister. Growing up, my family didn't have a lot of money. And we couldn't donate a lot of money. Again, we didn't let that hinder us. We took that as an opportunity to figure out what we could donate, and that was our time. And I think whether it's becoming a Big Brother or Sister, sorting food at the food pantry, donating leftover food, non-perishables that you have, there's a way for everyone to make a difference in this world. And I would like people to realize or understand that they can look past their limitations. And not to give up. There's things that people aren't good at. There's things you're not good at. There's things I'm not good at. The key is to find the things you are good at and excel at it. And you're going to fail, whether it's in business, whether it's in public service, whether it's in your personal life. You're going to find what works, and you need to take that and run with it. And I think that's the message I would like to relay to your listeners here.
Well, thank you for that, Jason. I really appreciate it. Would you like to plug your Twitter?
Yeah. I mean, people can follow me at Jason Nordoff. I talk about a variety of things, whether it's politics or technology or sports, anything that comes across my mind. Hopefully, you can find me on Twitter and give me a shout-out, and hopefully we can become friends.
Well, I'll have that in the show notes so everybody can see.
I look forward to discussing just about anything with anyone who wants to follow me or mention me. If anyone has any questions on public service, any questions at all, I'm more than happy to open myself up to inspiring other people or discussing with other people on how they can make a difference.
Well, thank you again for coming on the show, Jason. I really appreciate
it. Thanks for having me, Joe. I'm glad to do this.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Dreamers Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Dreamers Podcast. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/Dreamers Podcast. If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on the Dreamers Podcast, please send an email to j@jpar.co. This podcast is copyright 2014 by jpar.co.